Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
MSNBC is here. They're a little overwhelmed. They've never seen an audience this big before.
That, if you didn't hear it over the weekend, was President Obama at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, part of his speech ribbing the journalist at the high-profile event. Good morning, everyone. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. Now, among those not in attendance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Bob Garfield, co-host of our own On the Media, and Mark Leibovich, chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. Leibovich's bestseller, This Town, was just released in paperback, and that release was timed to the Correspondents' Dinner to make a point. The full title is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. That's the title of the book. They both join us now, Mark Leibovich from the Times Magazine and On the Media's Bob Garfield, to talk about the big name events of the weekend and why they boycotted them. Bob, Mark, welcome back to WNYC and the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hi, Brian. Good to be here.
So you guys hosted an alternative event, I'm told, during the White House Correspondents' Dinner while it was all going on, a major media ethics colloquy at the same hotel, the Washington Hilton. So how'd it go on Saturday night, Bob, with some of the biggest names in journalism right there in the building? Big turnout?
Crowd control was not an issue, as it turned out, for our media ethics colloquy, subtitled Red Carpets and Red Flags. There were the four of us, Professor Pat Alfterheide from American University, a journalism professor, and Jeffrey Goldberg from Bloomberg, and Mark, and I were there, and nobody else but the donuts.
How are the donuts? I'll ask you that later. Mark, why did you boycott this event?
Well, I mean, the New York Times stopped going in 2007, so I am bound by my employer's decision, but I wouldn't go anyway. I mean, look, there's really no reason for it. I mean, I think it's an abomination, and I don't quite know what we're celebrating here. I mean, it's not like the Washington media has completely distinguished itself. And we're hoping, though, that the ethics colloquy will have a bigger crowd next year.
Well, you say you don't know what we're celebrating. Is celebrating the right word? I mean, I won't cast myself as a defender of Washington, certainly not, or the dinner, but I wonder if it's the least of our worries. I'm sure both President Obama and Bush have spent much more time on their worry beads, fretting about how the press won't give them a break, than chuckling about how the good old boys from the press corps are happy talking to them after the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would agree. I would also say that this sends a terrible message. Not so much that there's a single banquet, but the fact that there is two dozen pre-parties and after-parties and brunches over a 4 or 5 day period, you know, tens of millions of dollars are spent on entertainment. And again, for what? I mean, the nation will survive. The Republic will survive. I just think that this sends a really, really troubling signal, which is, I think, one of the reasons the Times stopped going in 2006.
Listeners, did you watch coverage of the White House Correspondents' Dinner? Did you have fun laughing at the jokes? We're going to play a minute of President Obama from the dinner in a minute. Did you see these clips on the news later or online? And when you see them, what's your reaction? Are you just reaction to the content, reacting to the content? Oh, look, the president is needling Fox News or whatever it may be. Or is there something icky about the whole event, the whole star-studded, here we are hanging out, laughing while wages stagnate, kind of aura to the thing? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or are Bob Garfield and Mark Leibovich overly concerned about a non-issue here? 212-433-9692. If you have consumed any sound bites from the Washington White House Correspondents' Dinner, 212-433-9692. And while our guests were at their sparsely attended media ethics colloquy happening simultaneously, the president was ribbing the press in his speech. Here's about a minute.
I am happy to be here, even though I am a little jet-lagged from my trip to Malaysia. The lengths we have to go to get CNN coverage these days. I think they're still searching for their table. MSNBC is here. They're a little overwhelmed. They've never seen an audience this big before. Sometimes I do feel disrespected by you reporters, but that's okay. Seattle Seahawk cornerback Richard Sherman is here tonight, and he gave me some great tips on how to handle it. Jake Tapper, don't you ever talk about me like that. I'm the best president in the game. What do you think, Richard? Was that good? A little more feeling next time?
So a little ribbing for CNN and MSNBC and Richard Sherman to boot. Bob Garfield, do those jokes at the expense of the press make it any better?
No, they don't. And, you know, Brian, it's not just that Nero is fiddling while Rome burns. It's not just that this orgy of self-congratulation and self-importance takes place amid real problems. The problem is that this is an utterly opaque administration, though it came in promising to be the transparency administration. The press has historically little access to the White House and to the agencies. And yet there they were for five solid hours face-to-face with the President of the United States, his cabinet secretary sprinkled throughout the room, and not a single question was answered about Ukraine, about the economy, about the Keystone XL pipeline, about the Mideast peace process, about anything. And, you know, if I ran a bar and one of my customers was stiffing me on his bar tab, I'd be steamed. I would not invite him to my daughter's wedding. And here these people were as the guests of honor for the press, whom they have sort of humiliated over the past 6 years. And you want to talk icky, that's pretty icky. And if there's one thing that describes just how out of whack it is, there's a red carpet for a press affair. And paparazzi,
but Bob,
it's
broadcast
shouting.
Live. It's broadcast live on C-SPAN, so it's high-minded.
Yeah.
It's a high-minded red carpet.
Yes, it certainly is. And Sofia Vergara looked absolutely ravishing. But, oh, my goodness gracious, what a spectacle.
Trevor in Inwood, you're on WNYC. Hello, Trevor.
I think it's actually quite disconcerting the whole idea of the politicians essentially trying to ingratiate themselves to the media through somewhat facetious interchange. I think it's also a reminder that in order for the politicians to maintain their offices and maintain the good graces of the media, that they do have to be very obsequious with regard to reporters. And I think that, you know, just to put attention to the larger issue of the influence of the mass media on electoral campaigns, there's an article I wanted to share with you. It's titled Who Rules America? Not the book by the same name, but it's published by National Vanguard Books. It's an article basically documenting the very tendentious coverage of media candidates, and that it has a disproportionate influence on whether or not politicians maintain their electoral
so this is
majorities.
Really, this is really interesting. Trevor, you find the whole thing icky too, but if I'm understanding you correctly, exactly from the opposite perspective of our guests, you're not as worried as about the media ingratiating itself to the politicians as you are the politicians being forced to ingratiate themselves to the media. Do you see this as part of the same thing or kind of an opposite concern?
I think it's largely an opposite concern. I think it's the media that really has the upper hand in the whole paradigm of electoral politics and the media interchange of influencing public opinion. It's really the focus should be on the media as opposed to the politicians.
Oh, would that it were so. Would that it were so. The media do have an influence because all of the vast amounts of cash that are raised, more or less out of public view, that underwrite about $1 billion worth of attacks every election cycle, they do appear on the media and they do have an influence. But nobody's reading the newspaper.
Right. It's also worth pointing out that obsequiousness goes on every single day in journalism, in politics. I mean, this is a city built on obsequiousness. I mean, this is not so much about the conduct that pervades the city going on in a single night. I mean, I don't think in my years going to this thing, I don't think my incredible charm at the urinal standing next to some congressman got me a single thing in my profession. I think, again, the larger point is what message it sends, the larger coziness. And I think the major stories that have traditionally come out of Washington have been broken by outsiders. I mean, whether it was Woodward and Bernstein when they were just Metro reporters, I mean, they were outsiders when they broke Watergate, if you look at even Glenn Greenwald, I mean, this year, he was certainly not an insider, Michael Hastings a few years ago. So, again, you get this charade, not a charade, but just this big Mardi Gras within the club, and it sends a message that we're all part of the same deal, and there's this winking acknowledgement that we are all part of the same machine, and again, the question is what we are celebrating, and I'm not sure what we are.
And so, Bob, here is a bit of tape that you brought back from the red carpet. Here's you and Wolf Blitzer.
You look lovely as always, Wolf. Who are you wearing?
Armani.
Well done, well done. What's the what story are you chasing tonight?
Not chasing anything. We're here to have fun.
Ha. Huh. So no story from CNN's Wolf Blitzer, Bob.
No, nor from CNN for the last 7 weeks, by the way, because they've been obsessed trying to imagine where that airplane went to. But I sat there, Brian. They had cordoned off a press pen. Yes, at the White House Correspondents Association dinner, the working press was confined to a pen.
In other words,
I was in there.
Yes. Go ahead.
With a bunch of other cameras of celebrity journalists and so forth, reduced to practicing the only journalism that was practiced there that night, which was shouting at celebrities, including journo celebrities, from beyond the rope line.
I do want to congratulate you.
It was horrifying.
Mark, go
ahead. I mean, you got the Armani story. You got the Wolf Blitzer is wearing Armani story, and I didn't actually see that anywhere else. Hey, Brian, I just want to correct something you said earlier. You called the media ethics colloquy. You described it as sparsely attended.
Uh-huh.
That's incorrect. It was actually not attended at all, if you consider guests. So I just wanted to set the record.
Zero. So I have to work on my precision. If I'm going to report on the number zero, I can't say sparsely. I have to say not.
I don't know. It's sparse or whatever.
No. Says Mark,
and can I just declare and disclose that we never had any idea that anyone would actually show up. The whole point of it. Of this was – it was a stunt, right? It was to prove a point, which is that while several thousand people were downstairs rubbing shoulders with one another, we were upstairs potentially with an issue of substance that was utterly ignored. It was a media ethics colloquy held in the forest, and there was nobody there to colloquize. And therefore, it made no noise.
Bob Garfield, co-host of On the Media, explaining that his stunt was, in fact, a stunt. And Mark Leibovitz from the New York Times Magazine, author of This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital, as they talk about big themes from the book and why they object to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which was held this year on this past Saturday night. But Betsy in Blairstown is not that upset about it. Right, Betsy?
That's true, Brian. I called to say that I don't have the expertise or the insider track on this, but it seems to me that one of the problems of the past decade or so, at least, has been the lack of civility in political discourse in general. And going from Congress and going on down to when I, as a private citizen, try to have conversations with my neighbors, people have a position of speaking with no respect for the other person. And I think that when you have people who are all engaged in an idealistic way, making the country better, you have the journalists, politicians, and the politicians. And you have the Congress in Washington, where there is no longer civility when people talk about the opposing positions. I think that when you have a greater commingling of what are essentially opposite sides, and you can grant that the position comes from the other person out of a deep-seated belief system, then everybody I think in a sense wins, because you have to, when you acknowledge the other person as a real human being, and you talk to them mm-hmm. as though you respect them, as opposed to just shouting at them, I think that everyone gains something from that.
Mark, why not? In a town that's all full of silos and people on either side of the aisle can't even have brunch with each other without, you know, getting primaried, and the hostility between the press and the White House that seems to increase administration after administration, because we seem to have a progression of, you know, increasingly secretive presidents going back for decades now. So why wouldn't this serve the public purpose that Betsy is hoping that it would?
Well, I mean, I certainly take Betsy's point. I mean, I do think that one of the misconceptions about Washington, though, is that it is as divided as it seems on TV. I mean, I think the point that I've made in, you know, in this town and others have made is that it is, in fact, hopelessly interconnected into sort of a bipartisan club in which people essentially come here and they join this kind of ongoing party in which people cavort in the same green rooms and the same dinners and in the same lobbying firms and so forth. So what you get a sense of when you're at an evening like this is that Washington is not so much in this point of incredible division, but we're in this gilded age in which there are no such things really as Democrats and Republicans as they are millionaires. And this has become the wealthiest metropolitan area in the United States. And part of the reason is all the money that has flowed into politics and flown into and been thrown into what we're trying to do here. And again, this is sort of, as Bob said, a Rome's burning, the king fiddling while Rome burns image that I think that is emblematic of the whole thing.
You know, to Betsy's point, we have a clip of Tom Brokaw in an interview with Politico last year about these particular White House Correspondents' Dinner festivities. And he kind of says in this 15-second clip that it used to be the way Betsy described it, but not so much anymore. Listen.
It was at the end of the evening, I always thought, productive for both sides, for those who were public office holders or appointees of some kind in the press. We could get to know each other a little bit and talk about things in a more casual fashion. And then it began to evolve. It got larger.
It got larger.
He says evolve. I'd say mutate. or metastasize might be a better word still. If it was ever a good idea to have all of this collegiality and civility, as your caller said, it ain't a good idea anymore, because now it's just Mark talks about Suck Up City in his book. This was the sellout block on Suck Up City.
But in fairness, you did sound like you'd forged a good relationship with Wolf, and at least in that little clip.
You could trade wardrobe. Wardrobe tips.
We did not, however, after party together, though there were many opportunities. There were, I don't know, 7 parties after the party, Mark, and an entire weekend devoted to forgetting that the adversarial relationship is not going that well.
Since you're doing this interview from your home, Bob, I'm not going to ask you who are you wearing. But I will note that Kate from Brooklyn posted on our comments page, question for the guests, do they think there's a place for the role of public humor in a democracy? I've always been struck, she writes, by the scene of comedians making fun of the president in the same room. It always seems like a kind of ritual flaunting of a certain kind of freedom that I appreciate. So what do you say to Kate from Brooklyn?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I also think that, look, I mean, I fully admit to laughing at some of the lines President Obama uttered the other night. I mean, I think presidents of both parties have gotten very, very good at hiring good joke writers. I think presidents generally have pretty good timing and delivery. So, yeah, no, I'm not a scold against all humor either coming from presidents or people roasting presidents. I just think that, I mean, first of all, sometimes the humor does cross a line. And, I mean, President Bush a few years ago got into some pretty serious criticism when he was making fun of not being able to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was the radio TV dinner, but still same basic thing. But again, I think after a while you do devolve, metastasize into a point where you forget the basic seriousness of what the journalist's mission should be and what the politician should be here for.
Was Joel McHale that bad, by the way? Sometimes we hear, like after Colbert, had his year. The clips of him were all over the news. Sometimes it's whatever other comedian it was. This year, the only ones I'm seeing are actually of President Obama, like the one that we played. Nothing of Joel McHale. Was he that bad?
He was pretty funny, if you ask me. I thought some of his jokes were very good. But for whatever reason, and, you know, I can speculate, but for whatever reason, the crowd does not – this particular crowd, which presumably is people who, you know, are critical-minded for a living, draw the threshold of what is too far. Their bar is set awfully low. And there was a lot of groaning at what I thought were some pretty good pointed jokes, both at the press and the president and his political opponents. So, I mean, I was laughing at stuff that was making the audience groan. Of course, I was watching on C-SPAN.
Michelle, we won't tell. Michelle in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
You know, I'm no longer a journalist, but I'm shocked at how much the industry has changed. When I first began my career in 2001, you couldn't go to an event and accept a cup of coffee without being accused of being biased. And now, as government becomes less and less transparent, you really rely on your relationships with these politicians in order to get any story at all. And you know that it's one-sided, but it's better than nothing at all. And, you know, people aren't demanding that kind of transparency anymore. They're not demanding that kind of news. So it's one of those things, like, you kind of get what you ask for.
Michelle, thank you. We'll go right to David in Brooklyn next. David, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to say that it just doesn't look good when the country is really suffering and they see how the numbers are. And here you hear the prices of what it takes to make one of these parties. And when you hear that there's multiple ones, and who knows what it is. And if it doesn't look good to display how much the government spends on them having a good time when people are trying to make ends meet, you know what? The only way that American people can really ever protest is by shutting off the television, because they know that their government is not listening to them, because they wouldn't be doing this in plain sight.
David, thank you
very
much.
In fairness, it wasn't government money being squandered.
It's worse.
It was media money being squandered as we shut down bureaus across the world and don't cover stories in Ukraine.
Or is it lobbyist and special interest money? I mean, your book, Mark, is great on the really serious problem in Washington. You know, the A plus 100 number one problem, as far as I'm concerned, and how it's so much more awash in deep-pocketed interest, special interest money than it was even a few years ago. That's one of the reasons I shrug a little bit at the dinner as an issue in and of itself. But are they related?
I think, well, first of all, I tend to shrug a little bit at the dinner itself. I mean, I think the optics we've talked about. But again, it's the tens of millions of dollars that are spent around the dinner over a 4 and 5 day period. And yes, I mean, there's a ton of corporate sponsorship to some of these parties. I mean, at this brunch a few years ago, you literally saw an Audi parked in the lawn because Audi was a sponsorship of Tammy Haddad's like annual brunch, one of the many events that I'm no longer invited to at White House Correspondents Weekend, because I'm kind of the cockroach in the punch bowl. But I think what's striking, though, is one of the reasons that Washington has become this decadent city over the last few years is because there is so much money in the political system, corporate money flooding into the city, into both parties in order to try to influence every little thing in government, and with great success. So, yeah, I mean, that's extremely egregious and very much on display that weekend.
Astor in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, Brian. A great fan of your show. I have been listening to you like over 10 years.
Thank you,
so
ma'am.
My question is, do these dinners became popular during Obama's time, like in terms of being covered on media or in terms of attendance? Is it more popular or is it more or less the same?
I'll bet yes, Bob, only because there's more and more coverage of anything that's kind of pop culture every year. I don't even know if pop culture is the term, but it's entertaining and distracting. But so that's my impression of how much coverage there is now compared to 8 years ago, 5 years ago of the correspondence dinner. But what's yours?
I think we're seeing the effects of the convergence of the kind of cash and lobbying culture that Mark was writing about, and the celebrity culture that has, you know, so swept the society. And when the moment someone it dawned on somebody that you could that there were celebrities going to this event and more each year, and that if you put a red carpet out and got the entertainment press there, and Kardashians started to show up, and any number of Kardashian spawn have appeared in the last few years at this event, that all of a sudden you could turn a kind of a frumpy Washington dinner featuring mainly stained tuxedo shirts into some sort of Washington version of the Golden Globes.
Before you go, Mark, I will note that you told New York Magazine that some of the events looked more, quote, B-list this year than they have in previous years. And I wonder if you think that's actually a good sign, in that some of the so-called A-list guests are actually starting to shun it themselves.
I would hope so. I think it's a good sign. I mean, look, I wasn't invited to a lot of these things, but I certainly read a lot of names that I just rolled my eyes at, like, wow, they're here. Look, it's all about self-interest here in D.C. and also in Hollywood, and I think once diminishing returns roll in, people are going to stop going. So, yeah, I think that's good for the dinner. It's good for America, and I think maybe next year we can
Mr. Humblebrag, I think, Brian, I should observe, since Mark hasn't, that if there has been a kind of tamping down of the celebrity effect, it has a lot to do with Mark's book, which came out a year ago, which, in addition to Brokaw's comments from a couple years ago, shone the light on the extravagance of the event and just the poor optics. And I think if there was a lesser celebrity focus this year than in past years, it was a direct result of the shaming that that Mark
and
put on them.
So we will have to leave it there with Mark Leibovich, chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, also known as Mr. Humblebrag, and author of that book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking and America's Gilded Capital, now out in paperback. And Bob Garfield, co-host of On the Media. And Bob, we don't usually traffic in rumors on this show, but I heard a rumor that next week's On the Media will be a special hour on Washington and the press. Can you confirm this?
I cannot personally confirm it, but sources tell me strictly on background that there will be a special hour of On the Media devoted entirely to Washington, culminating, Brian, in the spectacle that is the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
We will see if Wolf Blitzer has more on the story later in the day. Thank you both very much. Good talk.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Now, Mayor de Blasio, a couple of minutes ago, started a press conference announcing his big and long-awaited affordable housing plan. We've been monitoring, and after this break, we'll play you some highlights and we'll talk about what they mean. Stay with us.